Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
94 WIP HD1 Philadelphia. Live from the Tasty Cake Studios. The Phillies play here. Sports Radio 94 WIP. A radio.com sports station.
Comes down to this. 34-27, 28 seconds to go. There's a new guy in at the left corner position for the Eagles, Craig James, replacing Sidney Jones, who got hurt, and Avante Maddox, who got hurt. And they run a switch route here at the top. Aaron Rodgers wants to go to Marquez Valdez-Scantling, except Craig James does a great job of getting through the pick and tipping the ball out so that Nigel Bradham can get up and save the day. Three shots to the end zone by the Packers. Three separate drives. They came away with 3 points. Eagles red zone defense. And those six plays helped win the game and save the Eagles season.
Well, indeed they did. And I love that kind of analysis. Ray Dinger, it's a delight to welcome our guest for today's Tell Us Your Story, Brian Baldinger. He is really one of the most respected football analysts around. He had a 12-year career as a player in the NFL, including two with the Eagles. He worked his way up from the bottom of broadcasting to the top. And, Ray, we've talked about it. His Baldy breakdowns are just a must listen. Brian Baldinger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, Glenn and Ray, it's good to be with you here today. I'm looking forward to the discussion and the conversation, and appreciate that introduction right there from you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. If Wikipedia is correct, which it is sometimes, you were born in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
You grew up in Cherry Hill and the suburbs of Minnesota and then Long Island. Was it that your family was just trying to stay one step ahead of the law back then?
We weren't quite in those ways back then. My dad was a military man, went to the Naval Academy, coached football at the Naval Academy for a while, wasn't for him. Found out that Steve Belichick liked to watch film a whole lot more than he did, so he opted to become a pilot in the Marines, and so we were on Marine Corps bases and, you know, Philadelphia Naval Base and Quantico and some of those places, and then eventually sort of went to work at the FAA in New York at Kennedy Airport, and so we kind of bounced around and kind of stabilized a little bit there on Long Island, New York, and that's kind of where I think it sort of all kind of began for me.
You mentioned dad. Your dad worked for the FAA. Also, I remember you telling me that he was a helicopter test pilot for a stretch.
Yeah, he was. He was. He worked for Boeing. That's when we lived in Philadelphia in Cherry Hill, I guess. My dad worked at Boeing Vertol, just south of the airport, and he was a test pilot for a variety of helicopters that they were testing at that time and using, whether it was for doing heavy lifting and building these cities and putting steeples up on churches and the tops of buildings and things like that. So he did a lot of that at Boeing for 3 or 4 years. And we lived at Cherry Hill, kind of fell in love with the Eagles and Philadelphia sports back then. Saw my first NBA game the year that the Sixers won their NBA championship, and saw the Eagles at Franklin Field and discovered what booing was all about. especially when Sonny Jurgensen was on the other side that they traded away to the Redskins and didn't really understand why the home team was booing the home team, but I understood that about Philadelphia fans early on.
You got it eventually. You went to high school, Massapequa High, home of Jerry Seinfeld, I know, where you played football and basketball and track. What did you do in track?
I was told that I wasn't very fast, Glenn, and they said that, you know, people that thought if you wanted to try to play at the next level, you should work on your speed. Well, I didn't have any sprints in me. I couldn't do that, but I ran distance and did the high jump. I think I jumped 6 foot, like maybe 6'4". Maybe I tried to go a little higher, couldn't really get over. I had a mental barrier, like I couldn't jump higher than I was tall, so I kind of stopped there. And then, you know, I ran the half mile, ran the mile, did some of those type of things in the distances. I was still kind of a tall, lanky, skinny kid. So I had some endurance about me, but I think it might have helped me a little bit, you know, try to get a little faster. You know, I don't know. I'm still kind of slow.
Well, you hadn't, if I remember right, you hadn't yet moved into the interior of the offensive line. In those days, you were playing a lot of tight end, right? You were a receiver.
I hadn't. So what happened, Ray, was I really was a receiver in our offense. I played in the defensive back. I mean, I was 6'4", weighed 175 pounds. I mean, I wasn't anywhere near what a lineman is supposed to look like or anything like that. So I mean, I was in love with catching the football. My dad was a tight end, was a receiver. I kind of just emulated him. He was an All-American at Navy. It's kind of like what I learned how to do to catch the football. I thought that was the most fun. Went to college. I went to the Naval Academy, didn't work out. And so I ended up going to junior college. And by that point, my body started to kind of grow and fill out a little bit. I started putting on weight, started lifting weights and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, you kind of just go from wide receiver to tight end. You just kind of keep moving in to the interior, you know, when they find out that you really can't run well enough to play out on the edge.
Yeah, everybody keeps getting faster. And if you're getting bigger, you're not. So yes, you said you were at Nassau Community College.
Yep.
Did you do 2 years there playing tight end? How did the transfer to Duke come about?
So I did. I went to Nassau Community College, which is a local community college on Long Island. A bunch of my buddies. It's kind of a standing joke, Glenn. Nobody goes to Nassau Community College. You just end up there. So guys that screwed up at four-year schools would come back and get their eligibility, then move on, or things didn't work out, like me at the Naval Academy. So you go there, and I played football and basketball there, and it was great. I mean, I got a chance to play and really loved playing basketball there. We were really good. Went to the junior college playoffs that year, went to the playoffs in football. And so I played an all-star game my second year at Nassau at East Tennessee State University. And there was actually a number of NFL players that ended up playing in that bowl game, in that all-star game. And when I was at that all-star game, a lot of teams came knocking. Duke was one of them. They sent one of their scouts there. And when it was over, they sent me down on a recruiting visit to Duke. And I went down there to Duke like in mid-December of 1978. And Duke was the number one ranked basketball team in the country at that point, and saw a game at Nassau Community at Duke at Cameron Indoor Stadium, and you know they were smart. They put a contract in front of me. They put a scholarship in front of me at halftime of that game. No pressure or anything like that. Just kind of presented me at halftime with a scholarship offer, and I signed it there and went back and watched Duke win the second half of that game that day, and ended up transferring, you know, soon after January 1st, and was a Blue Devil for the next 3 years.
Before we get too far away from Navy, I wanted to ask you about this. That you know, you mentioned that your dad went to Navy, coached at Navy, was a military man. You get an appointment to the academy, which is a big deal, and you kind of reference, well, it didn't work out. I, without going into great detail, was that a source of friction between you and your dad? Because I suspect that there's a part of every father that kind of wants to see his sons kind of follow in his footsteps. And for you to get into Navy and then choose it wasn't for you, I'm wondering, you know, how did that go down between you and he?
It wasn't good, Ray. It was not a good period in my life. I kind of screwed up. It's all on me. But I was sent home, Ray, probably into the first week of being there. I knew it wasn't for me. I was just sort of following my dad's footsteps, and I knew it when I got there. And, you know, I just did some things where you meet with the commandant of the Naval Academy, George Welsh, the head football coach at that time, and my father on a conference call, and you're being sent home, and your dad's got to listen to it. It didn't go down real well, and there was a lot of friction for a long time. But I was determined to make him proud. I had to go to junior college, had to really swallow my pride, didn't want to stay home very much, so I really would leave early in the morning at Nassau and kind of stay there all day, get my work done, work out in the weight room, come home late at night. The littlest time as I could spend at the house was better for about a year. When I got the scholarship to Duke, the tension started to ease, and when I made, you know, the Dallas Cowboys, tension was really kind of gone at that point. I kind of had to show them that I could do this thing on my own, and it was a good thing. But the friction wasn't good, but it was also a big, big motivator for me at that time in my life.
So you're at Duke, and as you say, you just keep growing, and they move you from tight end into guard. Every kid wants to catch the ball. Every kid wants the ball in his hands. Were you disappointed when you moved to the line, or did you just kind of look at yourself in a mirror and realize this is the position for me?
I love these questions, Glenn, because you're so spot on. I mean, the day they moved me, I'll never forget it. The day they moved me from tight end to guard, I thought the world ended. Like, I thought, like, it was Armageddon. That was it. Like, it can't get any worse than going from tight end to guard. First of all, I was only 235 or 240 pounds. I wasn't an offensive guard yet, and I couldn't catch the ball. I mean, I thought, well, what fun is it to play guard? Like, why would you play football if you play guard? Like, I was an athlete. I was a tight end. Mm-hmm. It was horrible. It was horrible. I mean, but I gradually accepted it, you know, and of course, you know, as you know, like Stevie Jobs said at one of his commencement speeches, he said, you know, you can only connect the dots looking backwards in your life. And so, you know, you start connecting the dots, you know, going forward after what happened. You go, this was a good thing for me. But at the time, like, I thought I had enough of football, and maybe I'll go out for the basketball team at Duke or something like that. But it was a tough spell. It was a slow transition. But then I realized that, you know, once I got to about, you know, 255 or 260, that I could play. I could play guard, and I learned to love it, you know, and so it was a difficult transition.
By the time you got to your senior year at Duke, obviously you're playing a lot, you're attracting attention, you're getting some honors. What was your thought about at that point about talking about going to the NFL? Is it something you really wanted to do? Is it something that was sort of on your wish list, or was it in your mind kind of a long shot?
You know, Ray, I played with this player at Nassau Community College, and he was a sophomore when I was a freshman. And I used to hitchhike back and forth to school a lot. And so I remember one day he said he offered to give me a ride home, which was way out of his way. But I think he just wanted to take the opportunity to kind of really talk to me, you know. And he told me that he was going to Fordham after Nassau. And he told me that, and I never forgot it, and I put it in my memory bank. But he told me, you know, Baldy, he goes, if you play high school football, you might as well try to play college football. And if you play college football, you might as well try to play pro football. And it seems so obvious and so simple. But he ended up playing 8 years for the New York Jets after Fordham. And he was the first NFL player that I really knew firsthand that I played with, you know, in college. And so when I was at Duke, and I'm getting to my senior year, and I'm a two-year starter there, and, you know, we're pretty good. We're a competitive team. Steve Spurrier is our offensive coordinator, and, you know, Bob Matheson is coaching our linebackers. You know, some great NFL players. Rich McGeorge from the Green Bay Packers is our tight end coach. I mean, we've got an NFL staff there at Duke, and, you know, they're telling me that, you know, you can play at this NFL level, Baldy. Like, you've got what it takes. And so I had that in my memory bank that, you know, I'm gonna play in the NFL. Like, I don't know if I'm gonna get drafted or how you do it, but I'm gonna get signed. I'm gonna get to an NFL camp, and you know, I'm gonna give it a shot at that level. I know that.
Who was the guy at junior college who told you this?
Kurt Sohn, S-O-H-N. Yeah, he was a returner and kind of a, you know, utility offensive player for the Jets for a long time, and from Huntington, Long Island, and, you know, he was kind of one of those mentors you remember.
So you're not drafted. You go to the Cowboys, an undrafted free agent. You make the team. That was the strike year. They only had 9 games. You played in 4 of them. Tom Landry, Tony Dorsett, Too Tall Jones. Give us some of your memories of starting in the NFL with what was really a glamour team at the time.
Well, I got to back up just a little bit, Glenn. I don't want to skip so fast.
Okay.
Because my brother, I had an extra year of eligibility. I got hurt my first year at Duke, so I got a free year. So I got a fifth year. When my brother was coming out of Wake Forest, he was a 10th round draft pick by the New York Giants, his favorite team. And so I'm not drafted. And that was like a gut punch. Like, my brother, who I thought was just a lazy bum, you know, at the time, could get drafted by the New York Giants, by his favorite team. you know, Parcells isn't the head. Greg Perkins is the head coach, but LT is there. And so the draft comes and goes, and I don't get drafted. And, of course, it wasn't advertised then. You read about the draft picks, you know, in the paper the next day. It wasn't on the radio or TV. So, you know, my brother calls me when he's drafted by the New York Giants. And, like, I'm like, dying here at Duke. And so, you know, when the draft ends, I get a call from Buck Buchanan of the Dallas Cowboys. And I thought he was Buck Buchanan from the Hall of Fame Kansas City Chiefs. I mean, I didn't know how little I knew. So I think Buck Buchanan is coming to try and, you know, offer me a free agent contract. Well, Buck Buchanan, turns out he's the equipment manager for the Dallas Cowboys and a retired Air Force colonel that ran the equipment room. And what happened then was the Cowboys would sign so many free agents, they simply didn't have enough scouts to sign them all. So, I mean, they signed 110 free agents, but they would send everybody. They would send secretaries and trainers. They'd send everybody that worked for the Cowboys out to try to sign free agents. So when Buck Buchanan came to my apartment and I met him, I was kind of like a little struck about who he was and why he was there, but he explained things to me. And at the time, I had a German exam to take, so I told him, like, you have to either stick around here or go sign somebody else. So he went to sign a free agent from North Carolina State, came back, and we negotiated, and I got him up to $1,200, you know, to sign me to a 3-year deal. And so, you know, I kind of joked that the Cowboys were so interested in me that the equipment manager, you know, had to come to my doorstep to sign me. I told him that I had a Plymouth Fury out in the parking lot with no brakes or tires, that I had to get it fixed. I needed enough money to get those fixed to drive it, and the $1,200 covered my cost. So I felt like I struck gold. But, you know, I'll tell you, the Cowboys were unique, and Ray knows this, but they signed 110 free agents and 15 draft picks that year. They had 125 rookies, and, you know, you go out there, and, you know, Tom Landry is, you go to mini camp, and you kind of, you know, they don't have a facility big enough to put everybody in one room at that time. Their facility was this, you know, it was like this dilapidated one-field place on Forest Lane in Dallas, suburb of Dallas, and, like, you couldn't believe that this was the Dallas Cowboys, but it was 1982. So I just remember the first time I saw Randy White at the mini camp, and I thought, I hope they put me at left guard. Because if I'm at left guard, I get to go against Randy White every day. And I'll know right away. Like, am I made for this thing or aren't I made for this thing? So, anyways, long story, they fly out. Cowboys were first class. They fly out from JFK. I'm living in Long Island. JFK to LAX. First class. I'm sitting there eating ice cream sundaes and three meals and, you know, on a 6-hour flight to LAX. They got all these people there waiting to pick you up and take you to training camp at Thousand Oaks, California, their summer home. And, you know, they lose my luggage. And I thought, oh, this is a bad omen. You know, they lose my luggage. So I said, I don't care. I'll wear the same thing every day. So even when the luggage showed up the next day, I never opened my luggage. I wore the same thing every day. So I'm going to wear it every day until they kick me out of this place. I'm not leaving. So they put me at left guard. I basically was a scout team guy. I did card drills for the starting defense, you know, every day in practice. And I went against Randy White every single day. And, you know, it was kind of unblockable. He was the best defensive, you know, lineman in the league at that time. And so it was great. And after practice every day, the rookies just scrimmaged. And we just had an all-out scrimmage, you know, 40, 50, 60-play scrimmage amongst ourselves. And they kind of got a real good look at you at that time. And, you know, I kind of started making a name for myself during that period.
Well, I remember talking to you about that whole experience, your first year there. And I think you told me there was something like 70 or 75 rookies that showed up. And you were the only one of the undrafted rookie free agents that wound up making the roster. So you obviously caught somebody's eye.
I remember I did. You know, I didn't back down to any of the veterans. And Randy White was kind of battling me every day in some of these drills. And I was having fun, you know, just going up against him. I thought it was a blast. A lot of people didn't think it was fun, but I was having fun. And then Ernie Stautner was their Hall of Fame defensive line coach at the time. And we used to all go into this team meeting room, Ray, you know, every night for a long meeting, 3 hours of film sessions and all that. And I remember one day I'm coming into the, you know, in the meeting room, and we'd take roll call and all that kind of stuff, who was there, who wasn't there. And Ernie Stautner just kind of grabbed me by the wrist. And, you know, he was a big old, you know, Bavarian, spoke with an accent, real stern. And he just looked at me and he said, they're talking about you, kid. And all I knew was the defense line. Like, they were like, this kid, like, he's a fighter, you know. And this was probably like 4 weeks into it. And we're getting ready to play, you know, preseason games or whatever. And I just remember, like, that was that's all I needed to hear from Ernie Stautner. They're talking about you. And I knew I was doing something right. And so first preseason game, I didn't play no rookie played in the first preseason game. This was a way different era. The veterans played. But the second preseason game, we were playing the San Diego Chargers. And I remember the offensive line coach, Jim Myers, we're on a bus going down to San Diego to play the game. We didn't fly. We just bussed down to San Diego to play the Chargers. And he said, I want every single play of the game plan drawn up against every front. And I want it at the end of this bus trip. So I go, okay, coach, I got you, man. I know what I'm doing. He goes, yeah, but I want it at center and guard. So I didn't know what he was, you know, what it was all about. But I was the first rookie to play in a preseason game. They took Herb Scott, the all-pro left guard, out on the second series of the offense that night in San Diego in the first quarter. They put me in there. So I'm next to Tom Rafferty and Pat Donovan, the Pro Bowl left tackle, with the first-team offense. And I'm going up against Big Hands Johnson, and they threw me in there. They wanted to see what I could do right away. You know, I gave up a sack, like, in my first series, so it wasn't good. But Herb Scott, like, he was talking to me. He goes, just get off the ball in Big Hands, Baldy. You know, just something stupid and simple. Get off the ball. Like, he wants to beat you fast, but if you get off the ball, he's not going to beat you. You know, you just learn. It was just learning. But, I mean, that was a big deal going in there with the first-team offense in the second preseason game. And so I was, you know, I was kind of turned some heads at that point.
You spent 5 years there, and it was the wind down of Tom Landry. How was he? I mean, Hall of Fame coach. What were your impressions of him?
He was unbelievable, Glenn. He literally, we had a team meeting every Monday. There was no Victory Mondays or Mondays off. We met as a team after every game on Monday, and Tom Landry went through the offense, the defense, and special teams. He was the only coach that did it. He went through every single position. It was a 3-hour grind session with Tom Landry. You could be you could be Randy White, you could be Tony Dorsett, you know, you could be Billy Joe Dupree. I mean, if there was a negative about what you did, he let you know about it. And literally, it was these players, they hated it, you know. It was a grind. They come out sweating. But he just knew the game that well that he coached every single position. And so, but I learned a lot from him. He just had you prepared like nobody else. To this day, I've never been prepared like that to play a game. After every four games, we always met as a team, and he went through the quarter pole of the season or the halfway pole, and he put up the reasonable goals, the outstanding goals, what we were doing well, what we weren't doing well. The outstanding goals were what it took to get to a Super Bowl. The reasonable goals were what it took to get to a playoff game or to the playoffs. And that's how the Cowboys thought. The playoffs were what we went for every single year. And if we were struggling in the slant series in the run game, these were the corrections we're going to make to the slant series. I mean, he had an answer to it. He just was so well prepared. That was his strength. And I'll never forget, I mean, I did play 6 years there. 1 year I was a redshirt, or I was on injured reserve for 1 year. But when I got released by the Cowboys after 6 years, I was actually out of the country. And I called the Cowboys, and I said, it's not enough just to be released by the Cowboys. I want to go and thank Tom Landry. I need to thank him for the opportunity. I don't know if I was going to play more football, if I was going to get the opportunity to play. But I made an appointment to see Tom Landry. And I was in the Far East at the time. It was in Thailand, and I was in Hong Kong, some places in the Far East. I came back. I remember I had a suit made in Hong Kong just to go meet Tom Landry. I was going to look at my very best. He always wore a suit. He wore a suit better than anybody else I've ever seen wear a suit, right? So I had a suit made in Hong Kong, and I go, this is how I'm going to go meet Tom Landry. And I didn't know if he was going to give me 5 minutes or – I didn't know. I mean, he never seemed like he had much time for anybody. So I go there, and we sit down. And 2 hours later, I left that room. And I told him everything I wanted to say to him. He told me things that I'd never heard him say about himself or the team or anything. And I felt like I had the best discussion with a coach I'd ever had in my life. And I just told him that. I told him this. I said, if I never play another down of football in my life, coach, that I'll have experienced more than anybody else that's ever played football has. So I just want to thank you for the opportunity. And, you know, I ended up playing 6 more years. But I felt like that 2 hours with Tom Landry was as good a 2 hours as anybody could have ever gotten with him.
That's great. We got to take a break. We're going to find out when we get back if Baldy holds Rich Kotite in that same regard.
Okay.
Brian Baldinger is our guest today for Tell Us Your Story. With Ray Dinger, I'm Glenn Mack now on 94 WIP.
All the cool kids listen at 2X.
Cool.
Listen to Sports Radio 94 WIP at any speed you want with Radio.com Rewind. Download the Radio.com app and favorite 94 WIP.
I'll show you 7 drop passes from the Eagles receivers on Sunday, starting with Nelson Aguilar running just the out from the inside slot position right here. Carson puts it right on him. He lets it hit his body, and it bounces off his pads. I'll show you Mac Hollins here with an offensive pass interference with Carson putting that ball in a laser right here, right on the back shoulder, right where he wanted to, and doinked right off his hands. I'll show you Jordan Howard. Presumably, if you go five wide receivers, everybody can catch the ball. On second down right here, the drop, second and eight, drop there. The most dependable receiver they got, Zach Ertz. I don't know how many he dropped. I'll show you one, though, right over the middle, right in his hands. Couldn't throw it any better. Started looking away before he pulled it in, and then it got bad. It got really bad. Fourth quarter, Dallas Goedert. I mean, he can't throw the ball any better. I'm not sure what Goedert was thinking right here. He's been doing this for a long time. Bad doink. And then on the final drive, all they need is a field goal to tie. Let's watch Mac Hollins right here. Carson puts it right on him. Aguilar clearing things out. Here it is. Ball is right where it needs to be. Can't throw it any better. Like, just a double, trying to double catch it. Got hands like feet.
Well, that's Brian Baldinger analyzing Eagles wide receivers last year. Ray, I can't really disagree with his assessment.
Nor I.
Baldy, when we left, you had left the Cowboys. You played 4 years with the Colts. You got to start a couple years, but I want to move it ahead because I don't want to run out of time. You come to the Eagles in 92, 11-5 under Kotite, make the playoffs, win a playoff game. What was it like blocking for Randall Cunningham?
I loved Randall. I mean, I really, really liked the guy. He was so odd and unusual. I mean, I used to warm up with him every day because you never knew what he was going to say. I mean, some days he'd stretch his right thigh muscle and his left calf. Like, he wouldn't stretch the rest of his body, just that. Or he'd go, you know, I'm not going to shower today, man. I got the hair just looking just right today. I'm not going to. I mean, he just never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. You know, he was the ultimate weapon. I mean, you didn't know really where he was going to be, what he was going to do. And that playoff win in New Orleans, I mean, they were, Vic Fangio was, coaching the Dome Patrol linebackers at that time. I was left guard that day. You couldn't hear Randall one play. But he helped engineer that comeback. I mean, he made some plays in the second half of the game that no other quarterback in the league could have made. You know, so it was, I had fun. But, you know, the next week we played Dallas, and, you know, the opening drive he scrambled, you know, and got a first down, and Ken Norton Jr. planted him, you know, at midfield, like on his back. And I went down the field to pick him up off the ground, and Randall just looked at me with a little daze in his eyes, and he said, "That's it. I'm not scrambling anymore today." That was it. Like, and he didn't. Like, he just threw the ball away instead of, you know, he wasn't going to get hit like that by Ken Norton anymore. So, you know, you just didn't know what you're going to get. But he was a lot of fun. I mean, I had a great time playing there in Philadelphia.
Well, I know that that was, of course, the era of the great Eagles defense, and you had that great defensive line, and I think they probably really kind of peaked right around that time. They had some great players, and you as starting offensive lineman had to practice against those guys, and I know they practiced at a pretty high intensity, and some of the practices out at Westchester got a little spirited, Brian.
Well, so I experienced that, Ray, and I was used to playing, you know, full speed in practice against Randy White, so I was all right with the tempo, and I'm going on, you know, I'm doing practice squad or whatever against Reggie and going up against him and different things, and Reggie, about, you know, the second week of this, pulled me aside. He said, "Hey, listen, Baldy, I really appreciate, you know, how hard you play and you practice, but here's the rule. If you see me with my chin strap unbuckled, you better not touch me. If my chin strap is buckled," he goes, "you come full speed me and, you know, good luck to you. Like, but you see my chin strap unbuckled and you come at me like you've been going at me the last 2 weeks, there's going to be heck to, you know," he never swore, "heck to pay." And I said, "Yeah, yes, yes, sir, Reggie. I got that one, you know." So I knew when he wanted to play and when he was getting ready for Sundays, but it was the offense against the defense. I mean, one thing about Seth and, you know, Byron Evans and that Eric Allen, I tell you what, man, they tried to score every time they touched the ball, and it started in practice. I mean, their mentality was, we're not a great defense unless we're a scoring defense, and that's what they tried to do.
Brian Baldinger, we have to transition this from your playing days to your broadcasting days, but I have one more question. I know Ray wants to ask you about your brothers, but I want to ask you this. The pinky. I think it's got its own Twitter handle. It's a celebrity of its own. What's the story with the pinky?
So we were out training camp out in Thousand Oaks. I don't know, maybe my second year, and I'm going up against Randy White, of course. And, you know, I'm just grabbing him for everything I got, and my hand got caught, like, inside his shoulder pads, and he jerked me, and the pinky got ripped out. It was literally dangling there, and I was screaming, you know, like a stuck pig. And I pull it out, and they end up taping it, and they go back in, and we, you know, practice finishes, and, you know, we go to the cafeteria that day for lunch, and I'm walking downstairs to the cafeteria, and the defensive line used to sit in the front row of the cafeteria, and they would literally haze everybody that came down there. It was back in the day of real good hazing. And they all stood up. When I walked in, the defense line stood up, and in unison, they all started emulating like a baby crying, emulating me getting my finger pulled out of the socket in the practice. And then all at once, they all kind of held up their hands, and they all had, you know, crooked fingers. And they just, in unison, said, "Join the club, Baldy. You're one of us now." And, like, that was it. Like, I thought that was a great thing. And I never tried to get it fixed. I said, "This is what it's like to be an NFL player. Like, I'm just going to live with it." And I taped it to my other finger for the rest of my career. And that's kind of how the story started, and the legend grew from there.
I'm sure you've had it. Is there any way, I mean, you could go to a hand surgeon and get it straightened out?
You know, so I played on a Winter Basketball League team in Dallas, Ray, with Roger Staubach. And Roger loved basketball. He had a basketball court in his yard, in his house in Dallas. And we played together on his team. And so one year, he said to me that his wife made him go get his pinky fixed, that she was tired of it. So he had a pinky just like mine. So he goes to get it operated on. It's in a splint. The doctor said, "Don't do anything for 6 weeks. Just leave it in the splint. It'll heal. It'll straighten. You'll be fine." So the next week he comes back, and he's not paying attention to the doctor. And we're playing this game. He's got this splint on. The ball hits it funny, knocks the splint off. The finger goes back out, like, in the left field. And I thought, well, what's the point? Like, it's not going to get fixed. And once Roger's pinky, like, didn't get fixed, I was like, there's no point to it. Something's going to happen. It's just going to go right back to the way it was. And after Roger's pinky, like, darted out into left field, I just never bothered to try to get it fixed.
Ray, I know you wanted to ask about the brothers.
Now, you've probably been asked this question, or maybe you've even researched it, but is there any other brothers, is there any other precedent for what you guys did in terms of you, Rich, and Gary have three brothers all playing in the NFL at the same time? Has that ever, I mean, I guess there's the famous family, the Nesser brothers, who played for the Columbus Panhandles back in the early 1900s. But since then, in the quote-unquote modern era, has there ever been three brothers playing in a league at the same time?
Well, there wasn't, Ray, until the Watts did it last year for the first time. Because Derek Watt was in and out of teams, but he stuck last year as a Charger. So the Watts did it last year, and the Fullers did it last year. The Fuller brothers out of Virginia Tech. So there's now two of them. There has been other three brothers that have played, but not all at the same time.
Right.
So we did hold that distinction, and I mean, it was a big deal. We always talked after every game. My brother Gary played in three Super Bowls with the Bills, but really it was my mother probably had more pride in it than anybody. She was proud because she had a fetus, Ray. So she was proud of being able to feed three boys when we ate them, you know, everybody out of house and home every day. she was a huge football fan, grew up in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh. And so it was a big deal. She was always a football fan, still is. And it was a big deal for her. So we helped make her real proud.
What I thought was really remarkable is the fact that Rich was a 10th round draft pick of the Giants. Gary was a 9th round pick of the Chiefs. You were totally undrafted. So you guys weren't exactly blue chip guys coming out. But yet combined, you played 30 years in the NFL. I mean, that's the amazing thing, that you all came up the hard way, and yet you wound up playing a combined 30 years in the league.
We liked the game, Ray. We really liked it. We were survivors. You know, for the most part, we were pretty healthy. So that played a part. But, you know, we were all pretty driven. And so that was a big part of it. I remember this. My brother, Richard, was with the Giants. He was in his second year. Parcells, the rookie coach of the Giants. And he traded him to the Kansas City Chiefs, where he started for a long time for Marty Schottenheimer in Kansas City. And then when Parcells took the job with the Patriots in 1992, Drew Bledsoe was rookie quarterback. He traded back for my brother to come back and play for him. Maybe it was 1993, and be a starting right guard and help protect Drew Bledsoe. So anytime you see Bill Parcells, and I got to know him quite well over the years, he loved my brother. And, you know, that and my brother loved him. So there was a real love relationship. He always missed him, really liked him in both places. And that's probably the, you know, I mean, if Parcells loved you, that's probably all you needed to take to your grave, is that Parcells really respected you and loved the way you played.
So, Baldy, when you got out of the game, well, let me put it this way. My first year at WIP was 1993, 1994, and I remember just starting to do those post-game shows, the pre-game shows with Angelo, and you were part of the team at the beginning. Was that how you broke in?
Yeah.
You left us all in the dust.
I tried to play in 94. Some things happened, didn't happen. I started really in 95, and I did. I did that post-game show with you and Angelo and others. Howard was around. You know, it was a good group. And, you know, I didn't really know anything about anything, you know, to be honest with you. I went to a broadcast school with Craig James and that year, and Mike Golick was in it, and Merrill Hodge. And, you know, we kind of learned, you know, a lot of the fundamentals. But I knew I had to get started. I knew I needed experience. I knew I didn't know anything. And I knew what I wanted to do. So I had to get started. And so that was just, WIP was my starting point, you know, 25 years ago. I started right there in the pregame and postgame shows.
I know that we had Mike Mayock on last week, and he was talking about, you know, that he was selling real estate, and it was a living, but it wasn't what he wanted to do. And he really wanted to get into football, and he had this idea of getting into broadcasting. And he went to talk to Steve Sable. And talked to him about it, and Steve said, "Hey, listen, you know, come with me. We'll cut a tape. We'll send it around a demo," and that's how it began for Mike. And I know from my time at NFL Films that you and Steve were very close, and I know you talked to him a lot about the fact that what you wanted to do, and I know how instrumental he was in you getting there.
No question, Ray. I'll never forget. I'm in a gym. I'm in a local gym in South Jersey on a Sunday morning, game day morning, and I see Steve Sable in the gym, and I'd never met him. Probably like 1996 or whatever. And I go up to him and I introduce myself. And I just tell him that I want to be an NFL analyst like John Madden and Matt Millen and these guys that are doing this, Phil Simms. And I said, but I the only way I could be an analyst is if I can watch tape and really study the coach's tape. And that's got to be the foundation of what I do. I got to know what I'm looking at. He said, I'll tell you what, come over to NFL Films. I'll introduce you to my secretary, Kathy Davis. And she'll get tapes made for you every week. Let them know. And so I met Pete Pino in the Dub Center and Kathy Davis, and they'd make three tapes. Always had an Eagle tape for me, and I'd get a couple other games each week. And they were all on VHS tape, and I'd plug them in a machine. I'd sit there at home and I'd grind away. And then eventually he let me watch with Greg Cosell and some other guys, you know, in the building. And that's kind of how it all got started. And from that moment on, I was the biggest Steve Sable fan there is. And then I got to know him really well over the years. And just the innovation and creativity and the mind of Steve Sable, there's simply never been anybody else like him.
We got about 5 minutes left. I want to squeeze in a couple of things. There are guys who go, everybody goes into the media and makes it, kind of finds his niche, right? Some are information guys. Here's this trade. Here's this move. Some of them are hot talk guys. You became the ultimate X and O guy. And it sounds like, I mean, you're talking about the story about being on the bus with the Cowboys and the line coach telling you to break down everything from center and guard. It sounds like breaking down film and that part of it was something you always enjoyed and were comfortable with.
It was assignment football. And, you know, I always thought the game that we all watch on TV, and 98% of all fans get their football from television. 2% of the fans go to the games. Whether you go to the games or you watch it on TV, the game moves too fast, Glenn. It just moves too fast to see all the moving parts of why a play works or doesn't work. And I always just found that when you slowed it down, you could stop it, rewind it the way a coach does, the way a player does when they do this film study, that you really learn the whys of a play, why it worked, why it didn't work, why somebody is an all-pro player, why somebody isn't. And I thought, that's what I want to bring to the average fan. That's what I want to bring to the game. I want to bring the insight that you learn from being able to sit in the film room and study this stuff over and over again and the patterns that it produces. And that became my niche, and it really has never changed.
I know that one of the things that you've always wanted to do, because we talked about this a lot, was you had an idea in your mind of the kind of programming that you wanted to create. And it wasn't just talk show stuff, and it wasn't just sitting on a panel, but it really was deep inside the game type of thing. And I think you've really created that. I think the Baldy's Breakdowns is that. I think film and the film sessions, the show that you've got running now, is just ideal for you. I know how hard it was for you to kind of convince the people running the state, the networks, that this would actually work. But I'm glad you've got it up and running because it's the perfect platform for you.
Thank you, Ray. I love doing it. And what it is it's nothing more than sitting in a film room with players. I mean, Carson Wentz, Doug Peterson coaches players, Minka Fitzpatrick, Deshaun Watson, you name it. Sitting in with great players and letting them teach you the game through their eyes. And everybody's different. You know, everybody has a different voice. Everybody sees the game differently. But I know this. I mean, you've been at it a long, long time, Ray, from being a beat reporter in Philadelphia. Glenn, you've been around it forever. The game constantly evolves. It constantly changes. And nobody knows it all. Dick Vermeil didn't know it all. He did it differently than Bill Parcells. And what you find out is that there's just so much more to learn. When I watched, I sat down with Minka Fitzpatrick this year, and he got traded from the Dolphins on a Tuesday and started for the Pittsburgh Steelers on a Sunday. And just to see his instincts for the game, the way he describes it, like I learned something about a free safety I'd never learned before. When you watch, I don't know, Amari Cooper or Stephon Gilmore get ready to face a number one wide receiver, you realize that he almost always knows the route you're going to run before you even run it. He's a fortune teller in some ways, but it comes from his film study and his preparation and what you do out of formations and splits. And these guys are really, really smart people, not just football players, but really smart. And I think that fans, when they watch this stuff, this is what they want. I mean, there's a place for the hot takes and all that stuff that's out there. There's a place for entertainment. But I find the fans I talk to, Ray, this is what they want. They want that second-level knowledge about the game, and they start looking for it as a fan. And I've always believed that. It's just been, you know, it's just slow for some of the people that run these networks to really believe that.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's great stuff. People can find it, by the way, on Twitter at BaldyNFL. And it is. I mean, you create your own content, as Ray said, and I think it's compelling stuff. One more from me, Ray. I'll let you wrap. I remember a couple years ago when we used to have you as a guest. We kind of lost you for a while because you went to coach football in Italy. That sounds like fun. I don't know whatever became of it, but it sure sounded like you had a good time with it.
Well, it came about. John Grisham wrote a book called Playing for Pizza about a fictional player that couldn't play in the NFL anymore. The only place for him to play was for the Parma Panthers in the Italian League of American Football. And I read the story with Doug Cosby, a former teammate of mine, and we went and coached the Bergamo Lions in the Italian League of American Football. I wrote a blog over there, Glenn. I'll wrap this up. I had more fun that year coaching a football team. I learned Italian. I told those guys on my team that I'm going to give you the pregame speech in Italian, parlo tutto l'italiano, and the final game of the season. I'll learn enough to get you running out of the locker room with your hair on fire. I accomplished that. But the blog caught such fire that John Grisham ended up reading the blog somehow and writing back to me saying maybe he should write a sequel to Playing for Pizza.
Wow.
So it was cool. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was very cool.
Ray, you got the last one.
Okay. I have to, since we're on the continent, I'll ask you the obvious question. Is it true that you ran with the Bulls at Pamplona?
I did. 777, right? July 7th at 7 in the morning every year. Three streets of Pamplona. A lot of stories. I ran with a group of my, friends of mine. One was a former punter with the Philadelphia Eagles, John Telchik, great guy. And I've got. In fact, I was running into the bull ring one day, Ray, and a bull was charging out of the ring. Somehow, I grabbed it, literally like the cliche, grabbed the bull by the horns, and got out of the way. And somebody captured it in some photography, and I bought 100 copies of that newspaper showing me on the front page of the Pamplona Times as evidence that I ran with the Bulls.
You live to tell the story. Byron Baldring, it really has been our pleasure having you as our guest today. Again, follow him on Twitter, at BaldyNFL. It really is one of the best follows there are. Take care, and boy, we hope and can't wait for there to be an NFL season so that we get to see all your stuff.
I feel the same way, Glenn. Thanks a lot for having me, Ray. Always a pleasure.
Same here, Brian.
Look forward to catching up with you guys. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Brian. Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.